The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I mean, it sort of started off when I was thinking about what to do after PayPal. And I'd always been interested in space, but I sort of started looking into it, and I went to the NASA website to find out when we're going to Mars. It seems like, obviously, that is the next thing after the moon. And I couldn't find anything.
Over the last few years, the inventor and tech mogul Elon Musk has been making headlines, claiming that his company, SpaceX, will somehow transport humans to Mars in the next 10 years or so. This effort is extremely difficult, as we've seen this week, when there was an explosion on the SpaceX launch pad. No one was hurt, but it was a setback. Later this month, Musk is supposed to release his detailed plan for how he exactly intends to set up a colony on the Red Planet. Other privately funded companies, as well as NASA and some foreign governments, are all starting to talk about a Mars colony, not as science fiction, but as a reality in my lifetime, or at least yours. It's a subject very dear to the heart of The New Yorker's Josh Rothman.
There's never been a time when I have not been fascinated by the idea of going to Mars. I grew up as a science fiction kid, reading sci-fi novels and watching sci-fi television shows. I even had a dream recently where I was a Martian colonist having different adventures. So it's obviously still alive for me. But there are a lot of people who I really respect who think it's a bad idea. So I thought I would talk to another writer here at The New Yorker, Elizabeth Colbert, she's like the office's Mars skeptic. And about a year ago, she wrote an article for the magazine called Project Exodus. It's basically an argument for why we shouldn't go to Mars.
Would you have wanted to go to space yourself?
I would definitely go. Actually a kind of an area of regret in my life that I feel like through historical accident, I was born too early.
Well, maybe Elon Musk will rectify that.
Maybe I can retire to a space hotel or something, but that's not quite as exciting. So at the end of your piece, you talk about the fact that, essentially, we have a nice planet here. We've evolved to live on the Earth. And you end the piece by talking about the idea that maybe it would make more sense to tend our own garden on Earth.
Well, one of the things that intrigued me in writing that piece, and I read several books by people who were very boosterish about going to Mars, and one of the refrains that kept being repeated and is actually also used by Elon Musk as a rationale for going to Mars is that, well, you know, we're trashing the Earth and we can't afford, we need this quote-unquote insurance policy of another planet. And to me, that seems so, you know, ludicrous as to be interesting, because if you look at what we would have to do to reduce the Earth to the unlivability of Mars. Okay, so let's just review what Mars doesn't have that is useful to have for life. Oxygen, okay? Air pressure. You can't take a step outside of a pressurized compartment in Mars. Water, liquid water, to the extent that there's water on Mars, and that's debated, it's not in liquid form, so it's not in a usable form. So we would have to reduce the Earth to a place with no water, no air pressure, and no oxygen to make it as unlivable as Mars. And I am you know, someone who's of the opinion that we're treating the planet very badly, but it's still pretty hard to imagine how we could get to that point. And then you're saying, okay, well, Mars is an alternative to the Earth. It just doesn't kind of add up, in my view.
So one of the things that everyone, I think, has been captivated by is Mars One, where there's this idea that you'd go on a one-way trip, and large numbers of people have signed up for that one-way trip.
Right, which I want to say really, really freaks me out personally. But yes, yes.
I mean, I could be wrong here. I'm going to go out on a limb. But I mean, I think there's even something in the idea of the one-way trip to Mars that you don't return from it. I guess it's parallel a little bit to exploring the quote-unquote new world that, you know, that was a one-way trip for a lot of people. I mean,
right.
But what do you think motivates it, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask.
Well, I'm the kind of person, you know, who really likes oxygen and things like that. So I may be the wrong person to ask on that. But I once interviewed a very eminent biologist who described this as the madness gene. You know, we are a species. As a species, we've been venturing beyond the edge of the known world for a very, very long time. And he used the example of Easter Island. People somehow arrived at Easter Island, which is this tiny speck in the Pacific. And there must have been a lot of people who were lost along the way. And we keep going. You know, every place that's unexplored, we had the people who went to the polar north, and many, many dozens, hundreds of people were lost there. And you read these gruesome accounts of how they survived. And they went, in many cases, knowing that it was going to be extremely difficult and quite possibly fatal. And they still went. So obviously there is this, I don't know if it's genetic or cultural or what, but there is this tremendous desire to go where no one has gone before.
Okay, so Betsy makes some good points. That said, there are a lot of people out there who apparently do have that madness gene, and they want to go to Mars, even if it's a crazy plan. One of them is a guy named Jacob Hock-Misra. He's a researcher at the Blue Marble Space Institute of Science. And a few months ago, he co-authored a paper called A Pragmatic Approach to Sovereignty on Mars. And the paper is basically a detailed proposal for how the government of Mars might really work. How will it function? How will the colonies interact with each other? How will we settle disputes there? How will we manage to live in a place with such scarce resources? So you've engaged with this world in a lot of different ways. So you have the academic writing that you do. You've written a couple science fiction novels. I mean, I have to say, as an enthusiast of a sort of a big sci-fi reader, going through your CV, I felt like my life had taken a wrong turn somewhere and I should have been doing what you're doing.
No, totally, I appreciate that.
It's totally amazing. You know, let's suppose that we really do succeed in colonizing Mars. You know, it's the year 2030 and we've succeeded in sending enough people to Mars that now we have, you know, multiple colonies. What's the worst case scenario?
I think one of the worst case scenarios is that we repeat some of the destructive patterns of human history, where you've got different factions on a planet that fail to learn how to solve some of their geopolitical problems. They fail to solve some of the problems of the commons and how to share resources. And so you end up getting conflict and possibly violent conflict. And I think in space, you're so much further away from the militaries on Earth that that could potentially be even more catastrophic than something like that on Earth.
So I have a tall order for you. Is it possible for you to just give me an example of a scenario, like an intercolonial dispute of some kind that is the type of dispute that you envision happening on a sort of early colonial Mars?
Sure. So let's say that SpaceX is the first to go to Mars and they establish a colony near the polar ice caps, which would make sense because water is going to be one of the first resources that you need to sustain your colony. So SpaceX establishes themselves. There's no exclusive economic zone or anything. They just start mining water and taking up whatever space they need. 5 years later, 10 years later, the Chinese space exploration team shows up and they land in a very similar site. And they may very quickly be going after similar reserves of water. And that would very quickly lead to direct conflict where you're competing for the same resources.
And that would have repercussions back on Earth too, presumably, right?
That presumably would. Politics in space will correlate to politics on Earth.
Right. So, I mean, one of the questions I always have about this, it's easy for me to imagine, you know, year one through year 50 of Mars colonization being completely awesome. And then I basically imagine as soon as profit enters into it. Like, we discover massive uranium deposits under Mars, or we figure out how to sell water from the polar ice caps to newly arriving colonists, and there's now a Martian water baron, or, you know, whatever I imagine, some science fictional type scenario in which basically, as Mars becomes more of a fully functioning economy, it's just going to be exactly like, if anything, a more competitive and more capitalist environment than it is now. I mean, is there some sense you have that we could avoid that fate somehow, avoid the sort of reversion to the mean of human nature?
Yeah, I like to hope so. And I like to hope that maybe some of these the ways that capitalistic tendencies have played out, maybe they're not so indicative of human nature. The more I've thought about this, the less I tend to shy away from commercial interests, because without a profit motive, there's only a very limited set of things you can do with grants and donations and pure science. And I'm a scientist, so obviously I think very highly of those things. What I would like to see for, you know, year 50 plus in a Mars colony is that during those first 50 years that Mars has had enough autonomy, whatever that looks like, that they can that the Mars colonists can start developing new concepts of how to build an economy. I think that's not unrealistic. You know, one parallel I like to think about is art. You know, we have music and visual art and performance art on Earth today, but after 50 years on Mars, the colonists are definitely going to have different music and different visual art and different performance art simply because they're in a different environment forging their own culture. So I have to imagine that it's also possible that we could have different concepts of how an economy should behave, if the Martians at least are able to determine some of that for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, is there a do you feel that envisioning this future on Mars is a source of hope in your life?
It makes me feel like we have an open future. Maybe that's a better way to put it. I don't know if it's going to be good or bad, but the future is very open and we have a lot of possibility. You know, the astronomer Frank Drake, who was the astronomer to conduct the first search for extraterrestrial intelligence around nearby stars, he's remarked that SETI, searching for extraterrestrials, is a search for ourselves. And I think that applies equally well to any kind of space colonization. We're really putting ourselves in an extreme environment and learning how we respond and how we can thrive in that.
So I was just thinking about Mars this morning. So I live on Long Island and in a town that's by the Long Island Sound. And sometimes I'll go swimming in the Sound. And it's extremely beautiful and, you know, wonderful to be on the Earth, basically. And I was just thinking about, having just had this conversation with Jacob, what a bummer it would be to live on Mars. I mean, there's, you know, I wonder, is living in an artificial environment really living?
Yes, right. Right. And there are no other living things. I mean, I think that, you know, it's a completely lifeless planet. Now, are we indifferent to everything with which we share the planet, you know, which is, I should say, the source of all of our oxygen and all of our food and, you know, just trivialities like that, that we want to live on a lifeless planet? We consider that to be, you know, preferable to the planet that we have.
Yeah.
I mean, once again, I'm not necessarily the person, you know, to speak to this, because I'm not a big sci-fi fan, but I think my feeling is that is a big theme of sci-fi. You know, when you get to this place, where have you gotten? You know, that longing for home. I mean, we may long for Mars when we're on Earth, but think of, you know, Earth sickness. I don't know. We need a new term for it. What you would miss when you are on Mars.
That's Josh Rothman, archives editor at The New Yorker. He spoke with staff writer Elizabeth Colbert and with Jacob Huck Misra of the Blue Marble Space Institute.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.